Welcome to the Western Magazine Hour, stories and articles about the American West, produced at the Recording Library of West Texas.
Hello, this is Michael. I'm reading from True West Magazine's archives, August 1987 edition. Texas Ranching Heritage. Texas Tech University memorializes pioneering cattle growers, by Beverly Taylor. When George R. Joel returned from a Kansas cattle drive to find his home burned to the ground by Comanches and his family missing, he vowed to build a house in which his family would be protected while he was away. That house, carved of 90 tons of limestone and sandstone, couldn't be burned by Indians. The second-floor sleeping quarters doubled as an observation deck. From gun ports that faced the horse corrals, he and his family, which survived the earlier Indian raid, could scan the countryside to pick off approaching pillagers. That was in the 1870s, and Joel's fortress, known as the Joley House because of his cattle brand, protected his family until they moved around 1900 from Palo Pinto County, Texas, northwestward to the High Plains in Deaf Smith County, Texas. Today, rather than providing protection, the Joley House is being protected at the Ranching Heritage Center, RHC, of the Museum of Texas Tech University as a monument to the courage of frontier settlers who had nothing, no one to rely on but themselves. The Joley House is one of 30 authentically restored structures which tell the story of ranching, from the days of the free range to the affluence of the early 1900s, at the 14-acre outdoor exhibit in Lubbock, Texas. Walking along the self-guided trails of the RHC is like going back in time to vicariously live in the successes and failures, the joys and heartaches, the ingenuity and hardships of pioneers who built the nation's ranching industry by pushing into uncharted lands where their cattle could graze. Imagining is easy at the ranch, where the buildings look as though their occupants left only a minute ago to attend to something pressing, and any second will return to finish the jobs they left the half done. On special occasions and Sundays, May through October, docents dressed in clothing representative of the building's histories are stationed there to give life to the structures and to provide information about the buildings to visitors. Landscaping and plants native to the area and era from which the buildings came distinguish the buildings from one another. Berms or hills wind along the outside of the site and are a dominant feature during the first leg of the trail, where the older buildings are located. In the center of the exhibit, where the buildings are linked to more recent ranching operations, the land is level. The berms and the way they taper off are intricate details representative of the ranching's birth in the Texas Hill Country and its progression to the plains. Just as the buildings represent the best shelter cowboys and cattlemen could make for themselves at the time, the berms also shelter visitors' views from the Lubbock skyline and the sprawling Texas Tech University and Texas Tech University Health Sciences Center just across the highway. The structures tell a thousand stories. Stories of their own construction, architectural techniques, the economic state, the growth of ranching, and perhaps most importantly, of the pioneers themselves. El Capote Cabin. American ranching was born in the 1700s when the Spanish brought cattle north from Mexico for food at missions and frontier settlements. El Capote Cabin, built on land owned by French immigrant José de la Baume around 1830, represents those early days when ranching flourished along the coast of Texas. The log cabin, hewn out of elm and pecan trees, serves as headquarters for de la Baume's E.J. Capote Ranch on the Guadalupe River. The 2,600-acre ranch was 45 miles northeast of San Antonio. The crude cabin, with its one room and wooden floor, also tells of America as the melting pot, with ties to new homelands and to new loyalties. Count de la Baume was a French nobleman who was a captain under Lafayette in the Revolutionary War. He was at Yorktown when Cornwallis surrendered. After the war, he lived in Louisiana, which was then a Spanish colony. When the French Revolution broke out, he served as an officer in the Spanish army rather than pledging to his French ancestry. When Spain gave Louisiana back to France in 1800, De La Baume promptly moved across the border to Nacogdoches. In 1806, he was granted 6 leagues of land around El Capote Spring on the Guadalupe River. The cabin may have been built that early, but most likely not by De La Plume, who was fairly old by then. The shelter was probably built by French Smith, an early Texas settler and Indian fighter who was De La Baume's tenant from 1820 to 1845. During the Revolution in 1813, De La Baume, by then a successful rancher and businessman, lived in the largest house in San Antonio. In the uprising, almost everything he had was taken, including his deed to El Capote Ranch. His ownership wasn't reestablished until the late 1820s through the efforts of his friend and lawyer, Stephen F. Austin. Hedwig's Hill Cabin. Some settlers had better luck with Indians than George Joel did. One was Lewis Martin, who was among the first of around 7,000 Germans who came from their homeland to the Texas Hill Country in 1855. Martin and the others had planned to become citizens of the Texas Republic, but when they arrived, the Republic no longer existed, and promises for transportation to the Hill Country, which had made to them, were void. Determined to make the journey from the coast inland, they sold their possessions to hire transportation. Once there, Martin bought for his family a house built by John Klein in 1853 and named it and the mound on which it stood for his oldest daughter, Hedwig, the first white child born in Fredericksburg. Martin became a leader in the new community, serving as postmaster and sheriff, and Hedwig's Hill Cabin was a commercial center, post office, and stopping place for travelers and military units. His dealings with Indians were extraordinary. Indians helped him fight off white marauders, and they taught his daughter to ride a horse. But Indians weren't the only hazards of the frontier. In 1864, Martin was hanged with his own rope near Eagle Pass by white outlaws who stole the gold he was carrying to buy supplies in Mexico. The story goes that the bushwhackers rode to Martin's home, told his widow they had killed him, and then ordered her to cook a meal for them. The cabin represents the second phase of frontier construction. 2 cabins connected by a central passageway or dog run. The open space was built to provide ventilation to the 2 parts of the house, but dogs frequently made the shaded areas their home. Klein used a broad axe to cut notches in the logs. They were cut so precisely that the only nails necessary, and those were square ones, were in the door facings, which probably were added years later. The walls were plastered 1 or 2 inches thick with mud and grass, and rock chinking was dumped between the logs. Slaughter 2-story dugout. By the early 1900s, ranching had moved to the plains of Texas and other Midwestern states. It was the day of the free range. When C.C. Slaughter was 12, he was making a hand with cattle on the Patroon Bayou Sabine River divide. At 17, he began buying lumber in Anderson County and selling it in Dallas. With his profits, he bought wheat in Collin County, made it into flour, and sold it in Magnolia. He bought cattle with the $520 he cleared from the ventures. In 1887, Slaughter founded his Long S Ranch at the headwaters of the Colorado River in Texas. He had other ranches at Silver Lake and Running Water. By around 1900, he had established the Lazy S Ranch, which sprawled over Hockley and Cochrane counties. In 1901, he told his son George, the ranch manager, to build something cheap and small to serve as a line camp for the ranch headquartered at Whiteface in Cochrane County. George built a half dugout 13 miles from headquarters. Sometime before 1912, a box and strip upper level was added, making it a two-story dugout. Box and strip construction, the first construction technique in which ranchers used lumber, involved boxing planks placed vertically and nailed to frames on the top and bottom. Narrower wooden strips were nailed to the outside of the box to cover the joints where the planks connected. The roof was usually flat. The dugout and the way it was evolved into two levels is reminiscent of Plains pioneers who often dug their first home out of the ground and used it for shelter until enough lumber could be obtained to add the second floor. The underground level was a kitchen dining room, and the upstairs was the bedroom living room. Though the accommodations were crude and uncomfortable, the land in which they were dug was prime for cattle raising, which motivated the pioneer ranchers to endure. C.C. Slaughter, by the 1890s, had perhaps the largest individual cattle operation in the Southwest. Throughout his career, he worked to improve Texas cattle breeds by importing high-quality bulls to cross with his cows. He also built an empire of banking, insurance, and urban real estate. Barton House. As ranching grew and the railroads expanded their lines, small communities began springing up at centers of activity. Joseph J. Barton, the first Barton born in Texas, moved his family to Hale County, Texas in 1891 with the dream that the railroad would pass through the home section of the T.L. Ranch, which he operated. He sank his mind and money into building Barton Site, a community which included a school, church, store, hotel, lumber yard, three rent houses, and his family home, the Barton House. Three rival railroad lines were expected to cross Hale County. Only the Santa Fe Railroad survived, and it built through Abernathy, 14 miles east of Barton Site. Quickly accepting that Barton Site would never thrive, Barton moved what he could of the planned community to Abernathy. Barton House, which was built in 1909, remained at Barton Site. Barton had wanted to prove that with initiative and hard work, the richness of the land could be turned into riches for the pioneer. Though Barton Site failed because of happenstance, Barton overcame the blow and continued to prosper. Today, at the RHC, and for 70 years before it was moved, it stood as his testimonial. The home, which Barton designed after his grandfather's Victorian-style home in Calvert, where he was reared, is a striking contrast to most RHC buildings. The three-story green and white dwelling signifies the relative affluence many ranchers experienced with the dawn of the new century. The cowboys had made it with their land staked and fences up. They became cattle barons and splurged after years of making do. The house represents advancing technology. Railroad tracks, which by then crisscrossed the country, and a state of relative ease after years of hardship. The home includes elegant features and furnishings, a stereoscope, oak piano, phonograph, golden oak sofa, and armchairs, a black majestic cooking range, and wood-burning stove, two staircases, heated running water, two indoor restrooms, and acetylene lighting. Other RHC buildings and structures tell of education on the frontier in the one-room school, the ingenuity of pioneers as they worked to make their lives more productive and comfortable, the influence of foreign owners and investment companies, the benefits of the windmill, the impetus of railroading, and the growth of ranching into a major industry. The Ranching Heritage Center is open from 10 a.m. to 5 p.m. Mondays through Saturdays and from 1 to 5 p.m. Sundays, except on major holidays. For more information, contact the Museum Ranching Heritage Center, Texas Tech University, Box 4499, Lubbock, Texas, 79409, or call 806-742-2498. True West Magazine, August 1987 edition. Cheyennes on trial. by Gary L. Roberts. Curious people lined the streets near Union Depot in Leavenworth, Kansas, on the morning of February 15, 1879, hoping to catch a glimpse of the celebrated Cheyenne prisoners that the Army would turn over to civilian authorities that day. Near 10 o'clock, a detail of government ambulances pulled up at the corner of Cherokee and Front Streets, and blue-coated soldiers deployed into a line. Seven men, one of them leaning heavily on a board for support, stepped down from one of the wagons and moved toward the little group of dignitaries on the station platform. The crowd surged forward to get a better look at the dusky demons, as the prisoners were styled in the press, and the troops had to brace themselves to hold the people back. Lieutenant Julius H. Pardee of the 23rd Infantry moved briskly past the gawking spectators, saluted P.S. Noble, the Adjutant General of Kansas, and accepted the warrants proffered to him. He examined the papers quickly, declared them to be in order, and formally transferred the prisoners to his custody. In turn, Noble surrendered the prisoners to Bat Masterson, the young sheriff of Ford County. Masterson and a posse of men from Dodge City quickly ushered the seven prisoners into the depot to await the train for Topeka. For a moment, the crowd seemed threatening, but once the prisoners were inside the station, the danger of trouble passed. Now, Masterson got his first real look at the prisoners. Sitting on a bench together, they seemed more pathetic than dangerous. Wild Hog, the acknowledged leader, moved only with great pain. He was still recovering from an attempted suicide, and he ignored the reporters who tried to talk to him. Old Crow, who had served as a scout for the Army in 1877, spoke freely to everyone and quickly won the sympathy for being somehow different from the rest. Tangle Hair, also called Big Head, and Noisy Walker, the oldest of the prisoners, both limped badly from leg wounds. Porcupine carried his arm in a sling to protect a wounded hand. They all sat with the others, Left Hand and Blacksmith, downcast, sullen, and defeated, yet still somehow defiant and fearless. They were the survivors. The pound of flesh that the state of Kansas had demanded for alleged atrocities committed the previous autumn, when the people of Little Wolf and Morning Star, called Dull Knife by the whites, passed through western Kansas on their flight north from the Indian Territory. They were in Masterson's custody to stand trial for the murder of a mail carrier named Washington O'Connor, one of 40 settlers killed in the Dull Knife Raid, as the episode was called in the newspapers. The case would be watched closely throughout Kansas. If need be, cases could be filed in a half dozen other counties to make sure that someone paid for the crimes against Kansans committed by the Cheyennes in the fall. Still, neither Sheriff Masterson nor anyone else could be sure that any of the prisoners were responsible for the murders. The Army had surrendered all that is left of the Cheyenne Raiders, as Governor John P. St. John had phrased the matter in a letter to Michael W. Sutton of the Ford County Attorney. The truth of the matter was that no one could make positive identifications. Two, the circumstances of the raid, once known, made many people in the country, and even some in Kansas, sympathetic toward the Cheyennes. They were a remnant of the Northern Cheyennes who had been forced to emigrate to the Indian Territory in 1877, following the Great Sioux War of 1876. Used to lush green country of Montana, they found conditions in the South intolerable. In September, Little Wolf, the head chief of the northern people and their greatest warrior, told the white officials on the reservation that they intended to go home. In the pre-dawn hours of September 10, 1878, nearly 350 people slipped away from the agency, a desperate band of men, women, and children, moving north into country, rapidly filling up with settlers. Their attempt to escape seemed futile. The countryside was too densely populated. Too many troops were in the field against them. The distance was too great. The Cheyennes had too few supplies. But Little Wolf's people pushed on, obsessed by the thought of returning home. The Cheyennes always maintained they had tried to avoid the settlers. Perhaps they did. But collisions were inevitable. Needing horses and supplies, the Cheyennes raided farms and killed settlers in Comanche, Barber, Ford, and Gove counties, among others. The greatest toll was taken in Decatur and Rawlins counties, where the Cheyennes killed 28 Kansans in 2 days before they crossed into Nebraska. Unlike the incidences in southern Kansas, which seemed unplanned and incidental, the kind of episodes almost certain to happen in the admixture of Indian desperation and white fears. The murders in northern Kansas seemed deliberate and calculated. No one ever explained satisfactorily what happened there, but those raids changed the attitudes of many of their pursuers. A young lieutenant named C.D. Coles recalled later that the sympathies of the troops were with the Cheyennes. But when we reached their trail of murder, rapine, and desolation, our blood rose against them. Once in Nebraska, the Cheyennes came to a parting of the ways. Morning Star, believing that the people would be allowed to settle on the Pine Ridge Reservation with their Sioux friends, wished to surrender. Little Wolf favored pushing on to the Yellowstone. When they had talked, Little Wolf moved on with those who chose to follow him. 40 men, 47 women, and 39 children. They eventually reached Montana. The rest, 149 people in all, surrendered to a cavalry patrol on Chadron Creek near Fort Robinson, Nebraska, on October 23, 1878. For a time, Morning Star's followers remained at Fort Robinson, content to be at peace again, but determined not to go back south. While they waited, government officials debated their fate. On November 11th, George T. Anthony, the outgoing governor of Kansas, formally demanded that the principal chiefs, Dull Knife, Old Crow, Little Wolf, and others whose identity can be established as participants in the crime of murder and woman ravishing, should be turned over to Kansas for trial in the civil courts. A Kansas congressman stood ready to introduce legislation to force the issue. In Washington, the Secretary of the Interior and the Secretary of War agreed. They ordered the criminals to be identified and the rest of the Cheyennes to be sent back to the reservation in the South. On January 3, 1879, the commanding officer at Fort Robinson told the Cheyennes that they would be transported back to their agency in the Indian Territory. Morning Star quietly told him that his people would not go, that they would die rather than go. To force compliance, the commander ordered them locked in a barracks with no food, water, or fuel. The Cheyennes refused to yield. And on January 9, 1879, the soldiers took Wild Hog, an Elk Society chief and spokesman for the fighting men after Little Wolf left, Old Crow and Strong Left Hand, out of the barracks and incarcerated them in another building. Later the same day, soldiers took their families from the barracks and moved them as well. That night, the Cheyennes in the barracks broke out of their freezing prison. They had only a few arms secreted by the women in their clothing when they first surrendered. But they caught the guards by surprise. Men, women, and children plunged through the broken windows and fled into the darkness. 32 died within sight of the post grounds as the troops opened fire. For 13 days, elements of the 3rd Cavalry pursued the rest, picking them off one by one or in small groups until the last party of 32 people was cornered in a wash on Hat Creek. The Cheyennes would not surrender even then. For more than an hour, the battle raged before 3 Cheyenne men emerged from the wash singing their death songs. Armed with an empty pistol and 2 butcher knives, they charged the troops and died in a burst of gunfire. Only 6 of the Cheyennes survived the carnage at Hat Creek. Nearly half of Morning Star's people, 64 men, women, and children, were dead. A few, including Morningstar and his family, managed to escape. Most of them took refuge among the Sioux at Pine Ridge. The other survivors were returned to Fort Robinson. 79 people in all when added to those incarcerated with Wild Hog, Old Crow, and Left Hand. Of those, only 10 were men or well-grown boys. 58 of the survivors were eventually permitted to go to the Pine Ridge Reservation. The rest, Wild Hog, Old Crow, Tangled Hair, Left Hand, Porcupine, Blacksmith, Noisy Walker, and their families, were held at Robinson. On January 25, 1879, a military investigation convened at Fort Robinson. The Cheyenne survivors appeared before the commission during the first 2 days. Tangle Hair, a dog soldier chief who had fought the whites many times over the years, told the commission that the soldiers had killed most of his people. "These few women and children are all that are left," he said. "We beg you to have mercy on us and spare this remnant." On January 27th, the day after the majority of the prisoners left for Pine Ridge, Wild Hog's wife stabbed herself with a pair of scissors. Carrying her back to the quarters, the soldiers found that Wild Hog had stabbed himself several times with the other half of the shears. Neither of them died. On the morning of February 4th, 1879, the 21 remaining Cheyennes, including Wild Hog and his wife, left Fort Robinson for Sidney, Nebraska. There, on February 9, 1879, they boarded a train under heavy military guard. The women and children were en route to the Cheyenne and Arapaho Agency at Darlington in the Indian Territory. The seven men were bound for Fort Leavenworth and a rendezvous with Bat Masterson. The Cheyennes had already paid a terrible price for their actions, and sympathy for them was growing, even in official circles. On February 5th, Major General John Pope, commanding the Department of the Missouri, wrote an appeal to Governor St. John in consideration of the terrible suffering and tragic fate of nearly this entire band of Indians. "I most respectfully suggest to you that the ends of justice have probably been reached in this case, and that no further punishment to the feeble remnant of this band would appear to promise any results not already secured." 2 days later, the military commission at Fort Robinson presented its findings, blaming the murders on warriors with Little Wolf and recommending that they take no further action. By then, however, seven prisoners were already en route to Kansas, and St. John found it politically inexpedient to challenge public opinion in Kansas, where feelings still ran high. The legal wrangling that led to the actual transfer began on January 15th, when County Attorney Mike Sutton of Dodge City wrote St. John enclosing warrants in the case, the State of Kansas Plaintiff versus Dull Knife and 150 Cheyenne male Indians, commonly known as warriors, whose names are each unknown and cannot be given, for the murder of Washington O'Connor. That astonishing arrest warrant formed the legal basis of the case against the Cheyennes. St. John promised Sutton the only Cheyennes he could deliver and asked him to provide witnesses to help identify those guilty of crimes. Shortly thereafter, Sheriff Masterson, his deputies, Jim Masterson, Bat's brother, and Charles Bassett, and witnesses Major A.J. French and Kokomo Sullivan, left for Topeka and for Leavenworth after a meeting with the governor. Now, Sheriff Masterson had custody of the Cheyennes. At 10:40 a.m., the Dodge City delegation and the prisoners boarded the train and left for Topeka. At every stop along the way, crowds of angry citizens greeted the train. According to the Ford County Globe, the sheriff had to use physical means in preventing his pets from being trampled on. At Lawrence, Masterson had an especially difficult time. In his zeal to protect his prisoners, he struck one of the local citizens, who turned out to be the town marshal. Masterson found himself arrested for striking a peace officer. But as the Topeka Commonwealth reported, explanations followed and matters rightened. The sheriff and his prisoners reached Dodge City at 5 o'clock in the morning on Monday, February 17th. In the walk from the train station to the jail, one of the prisoners, probably Wild Hog, collapsed. Someone found a wheelbarrow and unceremoniously delivered him to the waiting cell with the others. Masterson apparently treated his prisoners well, and they appeared grateful for his efforts on their behalf as they settled down for what turned out to be a lengthy stay in Dodge City. 2 days after their arrival, the Cheyennes had their first day in court, appearing at a preliminary hearing. County Attorney Sutton was the prosecutor, and M. Watt W. Gryden, a local attorney, appeared for the defense. The session was brief and portended the future. Gryden wanted various Army officers and civilian agents who knew the Cheyennes as witnesses, and Sutton also claimed that his witnesses were scattered. Accordingly, Gryden waived further proceedings until the district court convened. For the next 4 months, the Cheyennes remained in the Ford County Jail. Occasionally, they were allowed to walk outside. Once the Dodge City Times reported that they were taken to the Arkansas River for a bath, where they disported in that limpid stream with aquatic fervor. They were treated well enough during those long weeks of spring to irritate many Kansans. Reporters visited them regularly, and Masterson told Adjutant General Noble that they were treated well enough during those long weeks of spring to irritate many Kansans. Reporters visited them regularly, and Masterson told Adjutant General Noble that they were all in good spirits, but want their squaws and papooses, which I am in hopes they may get. The formal indictment for the murder of Washington O'Connor did not come until June. On June 25th, 1879, the seven Cheyennes appeared in district court before Judge Samuel R. Peters. J.G. Moeller, an attorney from Salina, offered his services as defense counsel without charge. He replaced Gryden as defense attorney and immediately applied for a change of venue, charging that Peters was prejudiced against the defendants. Peters, apparently glad to be rid of a troublesome case, granted the request. 2 days later, Sheriff Masterson and a posse of five men left Dodge to escort the prisoners to Lawrence, where they would stand trial in the Douglas County courts. The change of venue was met with angry editorials in western Kansas. The Ford County Globe said flatly that all hope of civilization is lost, and an irate citizen wrote the Atchison Daily Champion that the decision made the case hopeless. The simple truth was that the state of Kansas did not have a case, and the court officials knew it. Moeller was busy issuing subpoenas to everybody who had responsibility for the Cheyennes, from Secretary of the Interior, Carl Schurz, and General John Pope, on down to local agents, interpreters, and junior officers. Sutton was having an even worse time just locating witnesses who he complained were scattered all over the country. Shortly after the prisoners were transferred to Douglas County, charges against Old Crow were dropped, and he returned to the agency in the Indian Territory. On August 12th, four members of a United States Senate investigating committee arrived in Lawrence and questioned Wild Hog and Tanglehair before proceeding to Fort Reno in the Indian Territory to continue their investigation into the removal of the Northern Cheyennes to the Indian Territory. The delays worked to the advantage of the Cheyennes. Wild Hog warmed to the press and gave frequent interviews, which won many friends for the Cheyennes' cause. The dignity and bearing of all of the prisoners had a strong impact on public opinion. A few days before the trial was set to begin, a party arrived to Lawrence from the agency in the Indian Territory. Ben Clark, the interpreters for the Indian Bureau, and Dr. Lawrence Lodge came as witnesses. With them were Old Crow, his wife and son, and his daughter, and the wife of Wild Hog and two of his daughters. The trial date was set for October 13, 1879. By then, the outcome was no longer in doubt. Mike Sutton advised the Attorney General of Kansas in September that a conviction was impossible and that the only thing left to do was to file a nolle prosequi in the case. At that point, he gave up all interest in the case. He returned his energies entirely to romance. He was married on October 1st and did not bother to show up when the trial began. That left the court without a prosecutor and absolutely stalled the proceedings until Abraham B. Jetmore, a Topeka attorney, arrived and announced that he had been sent to speak for the state. He asked for a continuance. Mohler protested that the defense was ready for trial and objected to a continuance, pointing out that the defendants had already been in jail for months and questioning whether the prosecution would be ready to proceed in a reasonable time. When the prosecution could not give assurances that they would be ready within a reasonable time, Judge N.T. Stevens denied the motion for continuance. Jetmore promptly filed a nolle prosequi, and Judge Stevens dismissed the defendants. The farce was over. John D. Miles, the Indian agent from Darlington, took the defendants in tow and returned them to the agency in the South, where their tragedy had begun. But official wheels were turning. The Senate Investigating Committee submitted its report in June 1880, recognizing the mistake that had been made in removing the Cheyennes south, and recommended that a Cheyenne reservation be established in Montana, and that at least some of the northern Cheyennes, still in Indian territory, be allowed to move north. In 1881, the Band of Little Chief was allowed to settle at Pine Ridge, and 2 years later, Standing Elk's Band also moved to Pine Ridge. Tanglehair, Old Crow, Wild Hog, and the others returned north with these bands. Little Wolf's people had been allowed to stay in Montana, and eventually all of the northern Cheyennes were reunited in the Tongue River Reservation, where their descendants live to this day. The case against Wild Hog and the others had been a travesty from the beginning. Yet even in the charade, justice ultimately was served. When the seven survivors of the Fort Robinson disaster were sent to Kansas, many Kansans expected a speedy trial and prompt executions or lengthy prison terms. But the Cheyennes did not get a kangaroo court. They had counsel, due process, and full opportunity to secure the witnesses they needed for a proper defense. The case fell apart simply because it was never a real case capable of prosecution. Many Kansans were not pleased at the outcome, especially in Ford County, which had to bear the full cost of the prosecution. But the Kansas papers said little. The nolle prosequi did not preclude further action against the Cheyennes, but no cases were ever filed. Kansans understood that the case had been an emotional response to the tragedy of 1878. When the facts were known, they realized how great a price the Cheyennes had paid. For most, it was enough. True West Magazine Archives, August 1987 edition. Arizona Fleet by Paul Taylor. The Colorado River wound through 400 miles of howling wilderness. The idea of steamboat traffic on such a temperamental stream, whose main channel was constantly shifting, seemed almost laughable. And yet it happened. Before railroads came to the Southwest, the military and early settlers of the new frontier were supplied by a sea route from San Francisco through the mouth of the Colorado to ports as far away as the Utah line. It is no exaggeration to say that steamboating on the Colorado was a unique experience. The nature of the stream, the adaptive design of the river craft, and the adventuresome men who operated them combined to create a kind of transportation unlike any other in the annals of the nation. It was said that a good Colorado steamboat captain could make 6 knots upstream on a heavy dew. The men who skippered the paddle wheels were resourceful, courageous, unflappable, and indomitable souls. They were a breed apart, at home on the water that contained almost as much red silt as moisture. Men like Jack Mellon, Isaac Pulhamus, and George Johnson spent the full span of their productive years on the river. Legend has it that Captain Mellon was capable of digging up a 300-pound anchor buried in the mudflat and carrying it single-handedly back to the ship. One day was never like another. Each predicament called for a new solution. The risks were enormous, the hardships were unbelievable, and the rewards were, relatively speaking, minimal. Even for the best of captains, navigation of the river was difficult in the clear atmosphere of bright sun of day. It was impossible at night, and the boats always tied to the bank during the hours of darkness. Casting off as soon as they could see, the captain spent half his time aground, working his boat around, over, or through the inevitable sandbars, and the other half trying to keep moving in the center of the elusive channel. Captain Jack Mellon described two of the standard river navigation techniques as grasshoppering and crawfishing. When his boat went hard aground on a sandbar, as it was destined repeatedly to do, the captain followed one of two procedures. In one, an anchor was walked out or lines were made fast to tree trunks on the banks, and the deck, which was used to pull the boat over the bar. That was grasshoppering. If the occasion called for the other technique, the captain backed his boat into the sandbar with paddle wheel churning and chopped his way through it. That was crawfishing. The novelty of the technique impressed the passengers to no end. "It is pure Yankee," one Swiss traveler exclaimed. Such incidents provided the only excitement to relieve the monotony of the trip, but even running aground soon became much more aggravating than exciting as it happened again and again. A feeling of oppression and despair often gripped the passengers, unable to escape the fine grit and sand which found its way into every crevice of the boat, every piece of bedding, every bite of food, and every breath of air. The accompanying wind might be so strong that the captain, unable to hold the steamer in the channel, had to tie up to the bank until the storm abated. On a river as shallow and unpredictable as the Colorado, the captains had to be resourceful in dealing with unprecedented and unexpected situations. During the summer runoffs, the river became a raging flood, and the captain's problems multiplied. In the winter, there were piercing winds and freezing temperatures. Captain Isaac Malamus wrote in his log on Christmas Day, 1879, "It blew northwest gale and very cold, froze all day in the shade, pipes all frozen last night, have been repairing pipes all day today, river this morning full of floating ice." Steamers left Arizona City, renamed Yuma in February 1873, every few days for the upriver landings, usually towing a barge load of freight and booked up with passengers. The deck fare was about two-thirds the price of a cabin. Deck passengers were given meals, mattress, and straw pillow for bedding. The cabins offered privacy and shelter from the occasional rain, but little else. Cabin passengers did have the honor of eating at the captain's table, but the food generally was as spartan as the accommodations. Though passengers were occasionally treated to fresh meat and vegetables, dinner most often consisted of butterless biscuits, salt-boiled beef or pork, and Arizona strawberries, dry beans. The river water used for drinking had to stand for several days to settle out the fine silt, after which it was put in porous canteens, hung over the deck railing, and cooled a bit by evaporation. The traveler who wanted anything else to drink had to bring it with him. The insects were large and voracious, and most of the passengers sweltered in their cabins at night. The only crew member who was obliged to stay out was the night watchman. According to the Yuma Sentinel, he had to take extraordinary precautions. He wore close-fitting canvas trousers and jacket, fisherman's boots, a wire helmet, and mask covered with a fine gauze gauntlets. In the sole of each boot was a hole plugged with a cork. When the inside man felt that his boots were about full of perspiration, he pulled the corks. A single privy, located at the rear of the boat, next to the paddle wheel, accommodated the crews and passengers. To get to it, one had to walk the length of a deck, covered with galvanized iron, which absorbed the heat and burned through the thin soles of ladies' shoes. The steamboat captains earned $200 a month. Crews consisted of an engineer, who also drew from $160 to $200 a month, and a first mate, a fireman, and a cook, each of whom made $75. An assistant fireman earned $40. A steward was paid $25. Yankee deckhands got $35 a month. Sonorans and Kansans, $25. Cocopa, Yuma, and Mojave Indians were paid $15 a month. The barges also had a captain, or steerer, who drew $75 a month and two deckhands. All hands received board. As early as 1894, press agents were ballyhooing the resources and scenic beauty of the Colorado. One excursion boat announcement proclaimed, "The foremost object of this excursion is to show the possibilities of mining and agriculture of the country, through which it will extend. But it will have other attractions as well. With none of the hazardous hardships and privations roughing it, in saddle or on foot, the trip will be through the heart of the most weird and awesome scenery on earth. Nowhere else to be seen except the abysmal chasms and gorges of the Colorado River. The trip is full of thrilling interest. At times, the view will be unobstructed on either side for miles. Again, the gritty little craft will be puffing and wheezing through narrow gorges with walls so high and abrupt as to almost obscure the light of day. In four places along the route, the rapids are so heavy and fierce that, but for the aid of a sturdy shoreline, there would be quite impassable. Ring bolts have been securely fastened into the walls of the canyon, and a cable suspended therefrom to a steam capstan in the bow of the boat is the tedious but certain means of locomotion." Some 125 miles and three or more days above Yuma, the steamer reached Ehrenberg, the second largest town on the river and the shipping point for central Arizona. Most of the upriver freight was landed there, and most of the passengers disembarked to take stagecoaches to the interior. To an Eastern lady who had to live in Ehrenberg, the town seemed an unfriendly, dirty, bevan-forsaken place. But to the thirsty steamboat passenger, it offered the first chance in days to drink something other than tepid river water. It is said that much of the something else was drunk there. A couple of days above Ehrenberg, the steamer came to the mouth of Bill Williams Fork. Though the fork was dry most of the year, it was nonetheless the only significant tributary of the Colorado between the Gila and Virgin Rivers. At the junction was Aubrey Landing, named for the so-called skimmer of the plains, Francis Xavier Aubrey, who had crossed the river at that point in 1853. At the peak of the river rush in the mid-1860s, Aubrey City had boasted some 50 cabins and stores, but it was virtually abandoned when the first collapse of copper prices happened in 1865. A decade later, only four or five cabins remained, the largest of which served as a combination post office, store, saloon, and hotel. An old ship's captain served as the office of the Colorado Steam Navigation Company, and the other huts saw life only when the freight teams were in, loading supplies for the mines and camps on up Bill Williams Fork. The Planet Mine, a dozen miles up the fork, shipped copper oil on nearly every steamer that had gone downriver since 1864. In the hills north of the fork was Jackson. McCracken's gigantic silver load, discovered in September 1873, McCracken sold the mine to Nevada Senators J.P. Jones and W.M. Stewart for $24,000. They moved the old Moss Mill over to Big Sandy Creek, just east of the mine, in 1875, and ultimately took more than $6 million out of it. Greenwood City sprang up around the mill. Within 2 years, two more mills were built on down the creek, and the rival camps of Signal and Virginia were founded. They had a combined population of nearly 1,000 for a time, all supplied by steamer and wagon from the landing at Aubrey. Some 310 miles above Yuma, the steamers were tied up at Hardyville, which was, for most of the year, the practical head of steam navigation. Though it never boasted more than 100 residents, Hardeeville was nonetheless the principal shipping center for northern Arizona, and for several years, the Mojave County seat. The mines in the mountains to the west had been abandoned during the Jalapeno War, which had erupted after the treacherous murder of Chief Waba Yuma in April 1866. Only a few steamers a year ventured above Hardeeville in an attempt to open a sea route to Utah. Freighting over the Mormon Road from Los Angeles to Salt Lake City was then a $3 million a year business. Captain Johnson offered to carry Utah freight for only $65 a ton upriver as far as El Dorado Canyon during high water and to Hardeeville at low water. That cut the overland haul by nearly half and the total freighting rate for the trip by a third, saving Salt Lake merchants more than $100 a ton. The Deseret Mercantile Association eagerly accepted the offer. Brigham Young, who for years had longed for a sea route to Zion, quickly dispatched Anson Call to select the site for a landing and warehouse at the river. On December 17, 1864, he settled on a gravelly point some 6 miles above Vegas Wash. He modestly christened the town Callville. There, he built a large stone warehouse and corral. A year later, the Arizona legislature created Paiute County out of that portion of the territory along the Colorado north of Roaring Rapids, and Callville was made the county seat. The honor was short-lived, however, because Callville and most of the county were ceded to Nevada in May 1866, becoming part of today's Clark County. By then, Callville's only inhabitants were a gang of fleeing horse thieves who wrenched the door off the abandoned warehouse to raft down the river. El Dorado Canyon was the only important settlement on the upper river until the turn of the century, though there were two paper towns which flourished briefly in the imaginations of their creators. The first was Freemansburg, the brainchild of a peripatetic newspaperman, Lee R. Freeman, who platted it at the mouth of the Virgin River in February 1868. Freeman proclaimed his town to be not only the head of steam navigation, but the sanctum of the American libertarian and the capital of the territory of Aztec. 2 years later, the ubiquitous Johnny Moss envisioned a second paper town, Paiute City, on the west bank of the river opposite Cottonwood Island. Its existence never went beyond an artist's attractive rendering. In the prospectus for the Paiute Company of California and Nevada, the drawing showed Paiute as the bustling shipping point for the company's mines at Ivanpah, 40 miles to the west. Though these mines were later developed, their supplies were carried overland from San Bernardino. By the mid-1870s, George Johnson and his Colorado Steam Navigation Company were doing over $250,000 a year worth of business, handling some 7,000 tons of freight and about 1,000 passengers annually. More than four-fifths of that income came from inbound freight, the tools, explosives, and machinery for the mines, the stamps, boilers, and heavy timbers for the mills, the supplies and equipment for the army, and the dry goods, hardware, furniture, and even food for much of the territory. The bulk of the freight was carried from San Francisco to Yuma at $50 a ton and on upriver at additional charges of as much as $60 a ton to El Dorado Canyon. Freight charges on heavy goods were based on volume, with 40 cubic feet being defined as a measured ton. A piece of furniture in a 4-foot square crate would thus cost the same to ship as 3,200 pounds of mining machinery. This practice obviously worked to the advantage of the mines, but was the cause of continual complaint from Arizona merchants. The outbound freight, which provided only a small percentage of the company's income, was made up of silver, lead, and copper ore, with seasonal shipments of wool, hides, and pelts. It was carried effectively as ballast on the ocean steamers and the downriver freighting rates were much less than those upriver, further helping to stimulate mining along the river. Miners could thus ship their ore to San Francisco from Yuma for only $10 a ton, only a fifth of the upriver rate, from Ehrenberg for only $12.50, from Bill Williams Fork for $15, and from Hardyville for $20. The remainder of the company's earnings came from passengers, more than half of whom were soldiers going to and from posts in Arizona. The coming of the railroad reduced shipping costs throughout most of the Arizona territory, providing a great stimulus to mining there. It was, however, of no benefit to the mines adjacent to the Colorado, where shipping rates remained the same as those charged by the old steamboat company. Thus, as the rest of the territory boomed with the expansion of the railroad, mining along the river languished. In May 1883, construction crews laying the Atlantic and Pacific tracks west across Arizona and east from California met at the Colorado River 25 miles below Fort Mojave. The tent town on the California side, dubbed Needles for the Pinnacles downriver, quickly became the largest port on the river above Yuma. With the coming of the railroad, the steamboat companies immediately lost over half of their income. The river towns were hit hard by the loss of trade. The population of Yuma fell from around 1,500 to only about 500. Every line of business was stagnated, and the local press damned the Southern Pacific's owners for having practically withdrawn their steamers from the river. At Ehrenberg, the last inhabitants were ripping the windows and doors from their abodes and heading for the interior. Once the most populous point upriver, it was virtually abandoned, refuge only for a few derelicts. Johnson's former partners congratulated themselves for their foresight, as John Beringham wrote to Captain Wilcox in May 1879, "The river business is used up. We got out of the business just in time." Ironically, it was at the same time that the Colorado steamboats finally reached that long-sought head of navigation at the mouth of Virgin River. On July 8, 1879, 20 years after Johnson first set out for the elusive Virgin, Jack Mellon finally proved that it was indeed the head of steam navigation on the Colorado River. The Mormons at Rioville were wonderstruck to see a steamboat. One proclaimed it the biggest thing he ever saw in water. The passengers on the steamboat Gila were equally impressed with the deep canyons through which they had come, vowing that they were the grandest on earth. Over the next 8 years, Mellon took the Gila back up to the Virgin a couple of times a year to get salt for the mill, eventually making a total of 20 trips. Captain Isaac Pullamus also took her up a couple of times. His nephew, Captain Joseph H. Godfrey, even succeeded in working the vessel Mojave up to the Virgin River once in the summer of 1881. Meanwhile, the only important mining activity upriver was the continuing work around Mineral Park and Signal. To shorten the overland haul to Mineral Park, Captain Pullamus established Pullamus Landing, some 5 miles above Hardyville, in May 1881. Within a month, a large warehouse was built, and thereafter, more freight was landed there than at any point on the river. On down the river, some freight was still landed at Fort Mojave and at Aubrey for the mines around Signal, but usually only a wood ship was made at the once busy landing at Ehrenberg. Later years of paddlewheel river craft saw the gradual replacement of steam-powered boats by gasoline-driven contraptions. The new models tended to be smaller and more specialized than their predecessors, and a good deal more unsightly. Still, steam remained in use until the early years of the new century. The steamship Searchlight aided in a fight to close the breach in the banks of the river south of the Yuma from 1905 through 1907. Diversion of the Colorado for irrigation of the Imperial Valley got out of hand and the entire flow emptied into Salton Sink, creating an inland sea that exists today. The Searchlight, credited with being the last steamboat to operate on the Colorado, was reported lost on the river October 3, 1916. George Johnson, who had built the Colorado steamboat business into the largest enterprise in Arizona, died November 27, 1903. But Jack Mellon and Isaac Polymus outlived the steamboats they served. Polymus died January 16, 1922, at the age of 94, and Mellon on December 17, 1924, at the age of 84.
Thank you for joining us for the Western Magazine Hour. Stories and articles about the American West. Your narrator has been Jack. You can hear this program on Recording Library of West Texas Radio and on demand with your computer or favorite mobile device at recordinglibrary.org.